Welcome to the Forency Podcast. Forency.us is a language training website for Hebrew, Arabic, and Russian designed specifically for intermediate to advanced learners. Our daily lessons prepare you to read real foreign language news articles and listen to actual foreign language media on a wide variety of subjects to put you on the path to language mastery. If you're studying Hebrew, Arabic, or Russian, you can visit our site at forency.us. That's foreignc.us. And enter the promo code Language Mastery for a 10% discount on our annual and 6-month subscriptions.
In this episode of the podcast, I spoke with Guy Shayet, who is the host of the Streetwise Hebrew podcast available on Apple and Android and presented by TLV1. Guy's episodes take a unique approach to Hebrew language learning that focus on context and giving students the tools they need to communicate with Israelis on the street. He's also working on a Hebrew slang manual that will combine many of the podcast lessons with plenty of new material. I hope you enjoy the show. I'm here today with Guy Shayet, who's the host of the Streetwise Hebrew podcast, which is presented by TLV1. And in the past, he was also led these urban language tours in Hebrew in Tel Aviv in a neighborhood that he lived in. But now he's focusing fully on Streetwise Hebrew. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I found out about you and your podcast by a Hebrew teacher of mine who recommended a podcast that was not necessarily designated for beginners, but people who were interested in learning real Hebrew or Hebrew that you could speak on the street that would prepare you for real life, which is how I came about finding you. And what I like about your podcast, one, it's digestible. They're in 8 to 10 minute increments. You seemed to have a knack for finding topics that are really prescient. They touch on culture, they touch on politics, but most importantly of all, they touch on language. So every topic you're presenting is integral to the Hebrew language and the culture. And I found that fascinating.
Thanks for listening. And thanks for your words. Basically, I think that I met throughout the years so many people that studied Hebrew, learned Hebrew, but when it comes to speaking Hebrew to them, you feel they are really detached from Israeliness, from the Israeli society, and from living and celebrating Hebrew, if you want. And I kind of decided to concoct a small, you know, a short formula, like a bite of language, culture, and things I cannot really define, which you can just inhale and later on use. So I try to make it things that we all need. We all need to say sometime, I'm fed up with this. I just love this. And I don't think that when we studied English, when I studied English in Ashdod, Israel in the 80s, someone taught me how to say I love and how to make this voice, how to say I love. But you need to teach, you need to learn these things. And that's what I'm trying to do.
So before you started the podcast, you were leading these language tours through Tel Aviv, which I touched on earlier. And I want to go back to that because I think a lot of the way you managed that and the way that you may continue to do it in the future is pretty connected to the way that you do your podcast. So how did you get started doing the language tours in Tel Aviv?
So the trigger was the 2011 demonstrations for social justice in Israel. And there were lots of demonstrators in the Rothschild Boulevard. They lived in tents. Outside every tent, there were posters, banners, and other signs that people wrote. And I took one of my students to the tents enclave, and I saw that sometimes she understood the words, but not the references. Someone added another word and turned something upside down. She didn't get these things. So I made a Hebrew language tour lesson where we walked, people walked with me with my whiteboard, and we read stuff and deciphered it and kind of, you know, took this, start peeling this onion and getting the language, the grammar, but also if it relates to politics and there's information you need to know and you're not from here, someone needs to be the mediator and tell you, okay, this is a show from the 80s. It's one line, but they change one letter. And then it alludes, there's another reference here to a pop song we all know. Nobody can know this unless they are taught or if they can get someone to show them around. And suddenly, kind of Facebook event, 20 people show up and I start to meet what I call Ulpan survivors or Sunday school refugees or people who try to learn Hebrew on a Sunday morning in Teaneck, New Jersey and ended up hating it for some odd reason. And I saw that Hebrew can be celebrated in the street. And many times, very often I meet people that had Israel of their mind when they were in the diaspora. And when they came to Israel, they found out that the language they learned is not what we speak. Maybe they spoke with Yiddish accent, which I respect, but this is not what we speak in the street in Israel.
Right.
And I felt that they need to connect in another way to Hebrew. There's another way to do it. Plus, I felt language trauma. People who were traumatized by either bad Hebrew teachers or people who were not that passionate about teaching Hebrew. And we needed some healing process of like linguistic healing, cultural rehab process, if you want to call it. And then came the tours.
And how much of that, of your experience doing the tours, informed how you were going to do the podcast going forward?
I feel that we need context always. Learning things, list of words, list of sentences without any context or story doesn't serve anyone. Right. Storytelling is a powerful tool. And if I tell you a story and you connect to the story, you end up remembering the verbs I used when the story reached this and this point.
Right.
I'm trying to create a story when I walk in the street with my whiteboard and we see a lost pet head and we learn how to say lost and red collar, chubby puppy and other things. So first of all, in this day and age with a smartphone, people can take a photo of it. You always have some dead moments where you browse through your photos and you can look at the new words. You have a story which is already anchored in your memory somehow. And later on, when you see the words, you get back to the story. Plus, the power of the street is it's uncensored. What we see on the walls or on sewage covers, this is what you've got.
Right.
You can pretend to have a picture-perfect Israel, but you're in the street. You will show what you find. If it's swear words, then let's talk about swear words.
Right.
So I like the uncensored, irreverent kind of feel. And I also like the way I can edit things. So for example, if I want to teach you the passive form, I can take you to places I know already signs. I'm taking you to this street and the second turn on the left. There is a house where it says something in the passive form.
Right.
Each time you'll pass there, you'll be, you know, your memory will work.
Right. I like what you said about it being unfiltered too. I wrote a blog post on Forensee a while back called R-Rated Hebrew Language Learning, where I pretty much just talk about how, even though it's kind of embarrassing and there's topics that clearly no university teacher, university Hebrew teacher is ever going to touch on, and definitely no Hebrew school teacher with middle schoolers or high schools will ever touch on, but to truly speak the language and to master the language, you have to learn all aspects of it, even if they're R-rated. So I appreciate you doing that. And when I'm listening to your podcast, speaking of stories, it's clear that you're not just a native Hebrew speaker who decided you wanted to help other people learn the language. It's clear that you've had exposure to language learning before as somebody who wasn't a native speaker of other languages. And I know that just from my own experiences learning Arabic and Hebrew, that I'd be walking somewhere and I'd wonder, how do I say that? How come I don't know how to say this? And then when I listen to your podcast, I notice a lot of the same things that you're doing. So where did you grow up and what was your exposure to language at a young age?
So I grew up in Ashdod, Israel. It's a port town half an hour south of Tel Aviv, on the coast of the Mediterranean. My dad was a tugboat skipper at the port. My mom was an art teacher. Our house was a living salon, which means it was open to people from really different backgrounds. Ashdod was full of immigrants from all over the world. But my father also liked to invite home sailors from the port. So I would come back from the youth movement and there would be a Filipino, Croatian, and a German sailors sitting in our living room and I would try to talk to them somehow in English at some stage. I think that always kind of stimulated thoughts about identity and who we are, where we are, Plus, we were an Ashkenazi family in Ashdod, which was back then a more of a Moroccan city. So either you're either Moroccan, North African, Algerian, Libyan, or you're Russian, and that's it. And a few Ashkenazi families. So I learned, I think, to switch, do some code switching between the Ashkenazi Hebrew at home and North African Ashdodian lingo outside.
And what about work experiences? Was there any, did you work anywhere that had a similar effect?
I think as a kid, you just switch. You don't know what you're doing even. You have a certain Hebrew for home and for Ashkenazim. And you have another Hebrew in the streets. And that's it. And only later in life, I met a linguist friend, Israeli as well. And she told me, wow, I keep hearing those Moroccan intonation in your Hebrew. And I was like, what? Like, well, what do you mean? And she showed me a few sentences and she said, yeah, it's the lilt. It's the North African lilt that you've got. I wasn't aware of that, although I studied linguistics, which just shows us that you always need to record informants and you don't know anything about the way you speak. You're not aware of these things usually. But I think I started learning languages at the age of 4 or 5. And I come from a very verbal family and lots of musicians and language people. So it came from there, I guess. And I always didn't like when people censored themselves and told me, oh, I shouldn't teach you this. Oh, you shouldn't know this. Or books that were part of an apparatus of what you should know and the other things you shouldn't. And I always wanted to reveal other facets of language when I teach. And I wanted to learn languages the way I teach Hebrew on the podcast.
Right. Yeah, it's always an interesting experiment when you're in, I just remember from being in Hebrew class in grad school in Israel and also in undergrad in the US and asking every single teacher I had, you know, how do I say to fart or how do I say to take a shit, you know, but they'll only say like, no, you say like shiruotim, you know, you don't say that. You just say you're going to the shiruotim. But, you know, I'm gonna be like, no, but if I'm with my friends, I'm not going to say like, I'm going to go use the bathroom. I'm going to say like, I'm going to go take a shit. Like, how do I say that? And, you know, they just refuse, even if you're alone with them, you know, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't ask them outright in class among other students. It's just like, they wouldn't do it, you know?
Right. So one of the most popular episodes of our podcast, Request Hebrew on TLV1 is the sex words. Mm-hmm. We did sex words 1 and sex words 2. And we have more than 25,000 downloads for each, I believe. And I do say in the beginning, if it's not your thing, we'll see you next episode. You don't have to listen to the show. But I think it's important to also understand that there is the conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and there is the load of history. But people still have sex, you know, and they do it in Hebrew. And you, if you move to Israel or you have an Israeli partner, you might want to know these words. So,
well, it's important also so you don't embarrass yourself, right? I mean, in the US, they'll teach you if you want to say, like, to finish something, they'll say, like most, instead of l'sayim. And the Hebrew slang for that is to orgasm. It's not to finish an activity, right? So
it used to be for right. My generation, we used to say ligmo, and at some stage people would start to giggle or to say something funny. Right. And the younger generation today, ligmo is to reach orgasm and lesayem is to finish. But back in the days, it was still okay to say, yeah, you need to be aware of these things. And I believe that hiding them will not solve the problem. It's like suppressing parts of our being. And I like also to think of everyday life. I tried the podcast. I want the podcast to be something very accessible that you can use tomorrow. You're on a bus. You want to tell someone, sorry, this is too loud. You want to know how to say different things. Also on WhatsApp and other on social networks, which are part of our life today. We need to do it now. We cannot write it in a book and publish it in 5 years. These are things that people need right now.
And also on the topic of slang, just being able to fit in with a group of friends or to speak more naturally. And those things are changing all the time. And I think I was listening to one where you talked about, it was either I was reading an article that you wrote or it was in one of your episodes, but we were talking about the AM/PMs that opened in Israel and how that developed. Instead of calling it AM/PM, people call it AMPM. So if you're able to break that into a sentence, you know, people may respect you more in the way that you speak Hebrew or feel more comfortable.
Yeah. So these little things, sometimes it's like tricks or like it's a bit like cheating because maybe your Hebrew is not there yet, but you're saying something in really updated slang and people like, oh, wow, where do you know this?
Right.
It could be like a fun thing, a party piece, a thing that you say when you meet people. I agree that it's sometimes it's a bit like it's a trick because your Hebrew might not be there yet, but you know some things. But I think it can open channels, which means sometimes you have a small window of opportunity. You meet people, you have an accent, foreign accent, and you want to say something to make them understand that you're fine. And you can say one sentence and they're like, oh, wow, how did you learn this? Or why did you learn this? Or who taught you this? And it can, you know, bring the conversation to another direction. I like it.
What's your creative process for coming up with one of your episodes? And an important component of every single thing that you do, every episode that you do, is mixing context with language learning or contextualized memory. So you're not just picking something out of the blue. Everything you're doing has a purpose. How do you go about now finding something to talk about? Because it's not like you're taking students on the streets anymore and you're seeing, you know, a sign for someone saying to clean up after your dog, and then you can start going into all that vocabulary. And
so first of all, people write me, listeners write and say, why won't you do something about sipur, story, lesaper, to tell a story, siparti, and maybe explain that sapar, barber, is not related, and other things. So first of all, I write those ideas. Sometimes they wait to simmer for a year. Mm-hmm. The podcast is already 5 years old. And I have to come with an episode every week, every Monday morning. I wake up and start working on an episode that will be aired on Tuesday the next day. And sometimes it's excruciating. It's sometimes really hard to find an idea and to write it. And it's a birth of an episode. And sometimes it flows just like writing. For example, today is Monday and I need to perform. And I'm not sure yet what I'm talking about. I have some ideas. Sometimes I have ideas a few days before. Sometimes it really depends.
Right.
I'm learning Mandarin right now, working on my intermediate Chinese. And
I don't think we mentioned before, but you're currently in Shanghai for...
Exactly. I'm in Shanghai. I moved here for my husband's work. Mm-hmm. And being a student again, a language learner again, makes you humble, makes you remember what it means to be lost in translation, to be surrounded with a language that doesn't make sense to you yet. It's really good to be reminded all the time. And if you teach your language, and sometimes we're all human beings and we tend to be impatient. Oh my God, these are, you know, mistakes again. But right now I sound like a first grade, second grade student in Mandarin. And it reminds me what it means. I'm not sure yet what I'm going to write about today.
Right. And does that ever inform your podcast episodes? Like, are you studying something in Mandarin and then it pops into your head like, oh, that's a good idea to go over in the podcast? Or are the languages so different that...
Exactly. Because if we learn like how to say, yum, you have yum in all languages, right? You need to know how to say it in Hebrew, or at least like a toolkit, like to understand like, what could I say for this soup? Can I say great? Can all the greats be used for a soup or only some of them? There are many nuances you can talk about. I love emails from listeners because they are sometime in Riyadh, sometime in Illinois, sometime in LA, sometime in Madrid. You never know. And they have stories and they ask me questions. They tell me about their lives. And it's always interesting because Hebrew, usually my listeners have stories about Hebrew, about being Jewish or finding out they're Jewish or not Jewish at all, but interested. So I'm very, very much in touch with my listeners and I talk to them. Mm-hmm. When I do the podcast, I'm thinking about them in the metro in Munich, commuting in Rio, just from the information they give me in emails.
I want to go back to the language trauma, the Ulpan refugees that you were talking about. So what are the most common things that you find Hebrew students got frustrated with in the past, or what caused that language trauma, and how do you help them get over it?
So first of all, the Ulpan is good for many people, but many people cannot sit in an Ulpan, either ADHD, or they just learn differently, or they are too tired after a full day of work and they cannot be in an Ulpan. Or there are 46 and everybody in the Ulpan are new immigrants from France and they're 19 and it's very difficult to be there. So we have to accept the fact that language learning is very personal and psychology does a lot of things. So if you have language trauma from the past because your parents compelled you to go on a Sunday morning to Talmud Torah and there was a rabbi there that was a bit scary, and was not a passionate language teacher, but was a rabbi that someone, you know, told him, okay, you have to teach. You end up sometime being an adult who is either afraid of Hebrew. Sometimes there was guilt involved of like, my family, why didn't we move to Israel? Well, our cousins are in Israel. They went to the army, but we stayed in Milwaukee. These are all feelings that are related to our linguistic psyche. You don't learn language in a void, in a language laboratory without any emotions. We have emotions in our soul that are linked also to the language. So just like a doctor does not prescribe the same medication to everybody, I have to work with one person in one way and with another person in another way. People tell me stuff like, there was this English person, I think he's 60 years old. He came on my tour. In the beginning of the tour, I asked, do you speak Hebrew? I said, no, I don't speak Hebrew. Okay. There were other people who did speak a bit of Hebrew or learned Hebrew. And I see that this guy is reading everything that we see and very fast. I was like, okay, you read Hebrew, ta kora ivrit. He said, well, I went to the cheder when I was 4 or 5 in London. But then one day I read medaber instead of midbar. Speaking instead of desert, because in Hebrew you have to guess the vowels. And the rabbi screamed at me, and ever since I haven't opened my mouth. Mm. So this person needs a teacher that would be also a kind of a healer, and that would understand that there are memories, bad memories there. You can't just teach. We're not in a factory. And it was interesting to see the spark in his eyes during the tour, like he's reading Hebrew. That's great. And he said he didn't, but it's a dormant part that came to life through walking in the street. I don't know if later on he continued with his Hebrew, but it was a start. And this is just one example, one story where you have to be aware of different things that happened to the person in the past.
So for the people that subscribe to your podcast, there's an option to donate for a monthly fee, or you pay a monthly fee and you get access to some different features and some extras. And one of them is a monthly group talking session over Skype, from what I understand.
Yeah, it's half an hour where we talk on Skype. Just now we had one. There were people from Austria, from Los Angeles, from London, from the East Coast in the US. We talk about different things in Hebrew, in English. And it's like a small community of podcast listeners, and we learn some things together.
Yeah, it's really, it's intriguing to me. I wanted to ask how you structure those. So is there a structure to it, or is it more free flowing, or do you know from the get-go, do you structure those similar to the way that you structure your podcast episodes?
Less structure than the podcast. The podcast is orchestrated to the breath.
Right.
The chat is not. We do a small round of like, how are you? Tell me something about your life in the last few days. And that triggers things. For example, today someone, David from Austria, said, "Lasot dvarim yoter kefim." I want to do more fun things. So we spoke about kef, fun, and kefi, which is the adjective. And many people don't know it. They know kef, fun, but they don't know that things can be kefi, kefit, kefiim. So I taught that. We also spoke about Thanksgiving, Chag HaHodaya in Hebrew, and someone thanked her stepson and told us a family story. Mm-hmm. So it's language, but it's also an encounter between people. And I don't mind if your Hebrew is not in the right level yet and you want to say something in English, it's free flow, no problem.
Well, it seems like it would very much benefit people who are able to hear you correct someone else's mistake or to explain why we say things one way and not another. And I never would have thought that a group Skype Hebrew lesson like that would be, I mean, it never occurred to me. I always do one-on-ones, but hearing what you're saying makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I won't say it's not challenging the levels because you get people from different backgrounds and different levels of Hebrew. And also, you mentioned correcting people. This is really sensitive and really tricky. How to correct someone in a polite, respectful, teaching way that would not touch his or her ego. It's not so easy to be corrected and not in front of people. So I try to be respectful and to mention to everybody that this is, you know, when I give talks around the world, especially in the UK or in the US, I start by saying, okay, this is a free space where we are allowed to make mistakes. I don't expect you to know Hebrew. I don't expect you to know any level of Hebrew. And I think people are really appreciate that because there's always a sigh of relief, like, whew, okay, so we're fine. So it's fine to make mistakes. Nobody expects anything from you. And sometimes I also decide not to correct someone. Mm-hmm. There's a flow. The person is speaking, is in front of other people. I can mention something at the end without pointing out who said something. But you have to be very tuned to the person and how they speak and what they say. They say something really sad about their dead parent. You don't stop them in mid-sentence to correct the verb.
Right.
Especially if everything is understood. The Hebrew language psyche will wait on the side until they finish speaking. And maybe I will not correct them at all. And this is not so easy to see your language sometimes like this.
And what are your tips for people who want to improve their Hebrew speaking skills when they're not in a session with you or they're just studying on their own and, you know, talking to yourself or imagining that you're talking to somebody is just not, I never felt that it was sustainable. Do you have any other tips for improving your speaking skills when you're not speaking with people?
So one of the things that I want to mention is that for those who become our patrons and add a few dollars a month, and I'm not promoting now my products. I just think
it's a good product.
It's a good tip. Basically, I record every episode twice. Once in English, and that's free for everybody. Mm-hmm. And once in Hebrew. What does it mean? It means that if you pay a few dollars a month, you get the Hebrew version as well, which is a mirror of the English text. Once you're intermediate or advanced, you can listen to me saying everything in Hebrew. With the songs, with the pop culture notes and everything. And then you can switch to the English and then to the Hebrew again. This way, basically, you listen to the Hebrew first. You have some blanks where you don't understand. You listen to the English, fill in the gaps, and then you listen to the Hebrew again after you learned. And this is an exercise that I love doing when I learn languages. For example, I listen to the news in Hebrew. I know that there was a plane crash in Indonesia. And then I switch to the news in Polish or in Mandarin. They speak about the Indonesian plane. I know the story. I know the context. Even if I don't understand everything, first of all, I get intonation. I get the vibe. But then I can take the text and start working on it because I know they're looking for the engine. I know someone found shreds of something in Java Island. This is an exercise you can do on your own with one piece of news that you can just Google today and find audio bits or just, you know, on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And this is one tip that I recommend. Another thing is context. So learning without context for me work less. So for example, even watching 2 minutes of a telenovela in Spanish with Hebrew subtitles. And a guy is arguing with a girl and you understand Spanish, you listen to it and you pause and you read the Hebrew subtitles. So first of all, you remember things. And if you speak Spanish, your brain understood already the context mm-hmm. and the sentence. Now you read the Hebrew, you write a few new words. Okay, done. 2 minutes, that's fine. You go back to your day.
I think when you were doing, or I read that when you were doing your walking tours, part of it was you would go to a cooking class sometimes. And for me, watching Hebrew cooking videos is one of the best ways of combining context with language learning, because they're like actively doing the activities they're talking about. It's not, I mean, if you're fighting with your girlfriend or your husband, your boyfriend, whatever, you know, you talk about a bunch of different things. You're not solely focused on the fight. But if you're cooking, you know, he's saying, I'm cutting the celery or I'm cutting the vegetables, and you see him doing the activity, and it's much easier to connect the two things then.
I agree. You inspire me now, because I'm going to check out some Mandarin cooking TV show.
Oh, good luck.
But I totally agree. And I think that these things, sometimes when we learn the language, we want it to be pure. We want them to use only Hebrew. But in Hebrew today, people use English very often to say, I don't know, to say a pie, pumpkin pie. People right. can say suddenly pumpkin pie instead of pie dlat. But the word pie, pe alef yud, is a pie. Although the dictionary will have some fancy words, which we don't use.
Right.
And we have to remind ourselves that, okay, use English when it's fine. Like, because sometimes as learners, we want to be holier than thou and use like everything in Hebrew and even biblical Hebrew when we can. But we need to take it down a notch to the street level.
Right. I mean, to speak in the street level, to speak fluently, sometimes involves mixing things in that a teacher or a linguist may not love, you know, saying,
exactly.
The low big deal.
It's a low big deal.
Sounds probably makes teachers cringe, or, you know, linguists cringe. Yeah. But if you're speaking to somebody on the street, you're going to come off much more natural than if you were to find the Hebrew equivalent.
Yeah. I remember when I was at Hebrew U at the Department of Semitic Languages as a student, I said once someone, "Kri et hazman shelach," take your time. And one of the lecturers was there, and he was shocked and he was saddened, and he was like, really? This is what you say? You translate from English? Take your time. There are so many ways to say it in Hebrew and proper Hebrew. And he was so angry with me. And I was just living without thinking too much, mm-hmm. speaking my mother tongue. And, you know, correcting someone's mother tongue is a big deal for me. But it just shows you how, you know, people can be purists. And I try to teach Hebrew, which is a living language, and sometimes copy things from other languages. It's not a new thing. Hebrew did it. Many things are from Aramaic. For some odd reason, Aramaic is considered fancy, and our judges love using Aramaic in verdicts and stuff. Mm-hmm. Aramaic was the lingua franca, was the English of the old days. So now we do it with English. No news here.
I want to shift to one of your next projects, which is creating a Hebrew slang dictionary. So where does that stand, and what was the inspiration to get started on that?
So I'm working on a manual for Hebrew slang. I don't call it dictionary because I think the structure is more of a manual. Mm-hmm. And basically the idea is to have sentences that you can use with different terms. So if you speak about kombina, for example, which means, how would you translate kombina to American English?
Kombina?
Yeah, like I have a kombina at Bezek, and I can get the phone line installed in one day because I have friends, I have connections. Kombina is sometimes connections.
Connections, yeah.
Yeah. So if I have a sentence there, it will be written in Hebrew underneath transliteration to Latin letters, underneath word by word literal translation. So you know how the Hebrew structures of the sentence, and then translation to idiomatic English. So I have connections there. And for each word like kombina, there will be a few examples and a blurb, a short blurb about what it is, a bit about its history, how it came from Ladino. That's like one page in this manual. I'd like it to be an ebook so you can update it, because slang is changing all the time.
Right.
5 years could be a long time in a life of slang word.
Right.
And I need to get 50% is already ready. I need to get back and sit down and finish this manual.
It would be great if it was like you say, like a living manual, I guess, you know, because things are changing. I'm sure the day after you publish it, you're going to be walking somewhere and realize something you forgot to include, and it's going to kill you, you know, like you're not going to be able to sleep at night because of that. So it'd be great if you're just able to pop in and update it accordingly.
Exactly. We have the technology today and people can also comment and you can just update things and add also links if there are TV show that like celebrating some terms or something. Another thing that I think that you asked for tips earlier, I think that on YouTube you find endless things about Hebrew, either songs. On my podcast, I use songs, and on the show notes, on every episode, I include the links so you can watch. If you hear a voice that you like or a genre of music that you like, you can click on links and find singers. Right. Lots of people told me, thank you for introducing me to this band or to Arik Einstein and other singers. And I feel this is another window, another channel that can, you know, you love a song and you start humming it when you wash dishes.
Right.
Humming, saying, learning the words, one thing lead to another. And yeah.
So when you decided to start the dictionary, you said you're 50% done, but how do you even start something like that? Where do you start and how do you decide what goes in and what you don't end up including?
In a way, the podcast is already, it's a work I've done on these things. Many of them are episodes that I should write in a different way, rewrite, edit. But I spoke about Kombina, for example, or if I speak about Nimasli, I'm fed up, or I just I find this amazing. There are many words to basically express amazement in Hebrew or stuff that you love. I feel that there's so much to say. That's not the problem. The problem is self-discipline and working on the creativity process and to make it happen. Right. Would you use the manual?
I would for sure. I'm always on the lookout for new tools and also coming up with, you know, my own methods and things that work best for me. I mean, right now I'm experimenting with just free writing, but not free writing like off the top of my head, but, you know, I'll find an article that on, you know, I'll just go to Ynet or, you know, Ma'ariv or whatever, and I'll open it up and I'll click on the first thing that pops up. And then I'll pull up, you know, my notes app on my Microsoft Surface, which has like a pen that I could write on. And I'll just start, I don't write word for word, but I just see things that stand out to me. And then I'll write those and I'll write the context that it's in and then I'll move on. But I don't spend my time writing things I already know or things that I know are going to bore me. I look for the things that I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I'm going to write that down. And I found that kind of helps a little bit with my speaking skills because it's an active thing you're doing. It's not a passive activity. So, you know, when you're listening, it's a whole different skill set and a whole different muscle that you're using. It all flows together, but I'm not finding the words and I'm not writing it down and thinking about how I'm going to write it and form a sentence or a word. So
I agree with you. I think you said something really important that if find things that are interesting. If you love aviation and you study Polish, find an aviation Polish website. And you already half is done because you love planes.
Right.
If you love macrame, just, you know, and you learn French, just do things that you find interesting. Otherwise, it becomes a chore and it's not so fun.
Right.
And that, by the way, I love your podcast and thanks for having me here. I listened to the podcast you had with Dr. Jonas Siboni about Moroccan Jewish dialect and loved it. So
thank you.
Just wanted to say that.
Yeah, well, I love everything you're doing too. And it's, you know, great for when I'm walking around Philly that to listen to those. And so definitely keep it up. And I appreciate everything that you do.
Thank you.
For people who want to find your podcast, it's available on iTunes and on Android devices. And it's called Streetwise Hebrew. And how do they donate to you? And how do they become a patron that can participate in your talks?
So if you go to tlv1.fm/swh, you'll be schlepped into the Patreon website where you can become a patron, or you just Google how to become a patron, Streetwise Hebrew Podcast, and you'll find us. It's very easy. I wanted also to say that I try to use a lot of Arabic on the podcast. I know that you study Arabic. I've been studying Arabic for many years. I think it's an anomaly that most Israelis cannot speak Arabic. And today there is a whole trend to learn Arabic. People are more excited about it. And I try to use wherever I can to find the opportunity to use Arabic, especially because many of the roots that we're learning are the same in Arabic. So I think it's a shame if you already learn something and Arabic can be just added, just learn it. because it's a great language.
Yeah, it's one of the, I think it's one of the most interesting topics ever because, you know, when somebody's speaking in Arabic, you know, you don't put the pieces together initially. You don't, you know, if they say, I opened this, if the verb is, you know, almost identical to the Hebrew, but it doesn't sound totally identical. So if I wanted to say I opened in Hebrew, you know, I would say patachti. But if I wanted to say it in Arabic, I'd say like fetahet. But it's the same root, fataha and the patacha. But, you know, for when you first hear it, you don't put it together and you have to go back afterwards and look at it. And then, you know, you say like, oh, it's totally the same thing. But for another conversation, I guess.
Exactly. So
thanks again for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah, I encourage everybody to visit your website and to subscribe to your podcast. And I look forward to the Slang Dictionary whenever it comes out.
Inshallah. Thank you.
Okay, take care.